is Detroit Today on 101.9 WDET. I'm Stephen Henderson. As always, thanks for tuning in. Wayne State University President M. Roy Wilson has had a lot to say over the past 2 years about leadership during the pandemic. He's an epidemiologist by trade who has specialized in racial disparities in American healthcare. It's a perspective that we've turned to here on Detroit Today a number of times during the COVID-19 crisis to talk about these unbelievable differences in the way the pandemic played out in the lives of white Americans and African Americans and other people of color. But now Wilson is turning inward with a new memoir that is both reflective and at times deeply revealing. The book, titled The Plum Tree Blossoms Even in Winter, looks back on Wilson's troubled childhood starting in Japan and journeys through his accomplishments, his setbacks, and terrifying medical troubles as an adult. It's going to be released on May 4th, and Wilson will host a book signing and meet and greet that day at the Wayne State University Barnes & Noble at 82 West Warren from 11 a.m. to 1 p.m. Wayne State University President M. Roy Wilson joins us now to talk about this wonderful new book. Welcome back to Detroit Today.
It's always good to be back, Stephen. Yeah. Thank you very much for the invitation.
Yeah, great to have you here. So I want to talk about the title of your book because I'm always intrigued by how people come up with the titles for their books. The Plum Tree Blossoms Even in Winter. Tell us the story about finding that phrase and why it's so meaningful to you now.
Yeah, it's an interesting story. So there's two reasons why I picked that title. One is it's deeply symbolic. The book is about challenges and not giving up, and even in the darkest of times that you can persevere. And the plum tree signifies that. It's a metaphor for that. Most blossoming trees bloom in the spring, in May, like the cherry blossom. The plum tree is very unusual in that it blooms in February, the darkest, dreariest, coldest time of the year. And yet something beautiful comes out of it. And it's just symbolic of hope, perseverance, resilience, all the things that I wanted to emphasize in my book. But there's another reason. And the other reason is my earliest memory as a child. I went to a cherry blossom festival with my mother. And after the festival, she went to a Shinto shrine to pray. And there was a little souvenir store there. And I asked her to buy me a little inscription of what I thought was a cherry blossom. And I wanted to remember the day, so I asked her to buy it for me. When I got home, I asked her to read the inscription because it looked like a cherry blossom and with lettering on it. So she read the inscription and it was the plum tree blossoms even in winter. Hmm. And I was deeply disappointed because I thought it was a picture, an inscription of a cherry blossom. And to find out that it was a plum blossom, I didn't know the significance of the plum blossom at that time. But I kept that inscription for my entire life, and it gave me strength during times when things were dark and dreary. And when my mother died, I put it in her coffin. And so it was the earliest memory that I have of my childhood. And it's the last thing that I did for my mother.
Yeah. So you write in the book about your childhood being a time of loneliness and deprivation and something that you had to overcome. Can you talk just a little about what caused those feelings?
Sure. You know, let me first of all say that this wasn't an easy book to write. I'm deeply personal, and I'm not that a person. And I portray my family, including myself, in ways that are not necessarily favorable, but it's brutally honest. And I tried to be balanced, particularly when it came to my parents. But, you know, they had their foibles and they had their good points, too. And I try to balance it out. But one of the realities is that my sister, who's 4 to 5 years younger than me, and I were alone most of the time when we were children. My mother was an addicted gambler, and in Japan, she would go to these gambling houses and basically just be gone for weeks and months at a time. Wow. And my father was in the military, and I'm not sure why he was stationed away so much, but he was never home. And so, you know, my sister and I basically took care of ourselves and for extended periods of time during our childhood. And so it was a time when we really had to rely on each other. You know, when she was just 5 years old, she was, you know, making rice from at home and having rice ready for me when I came home from school. She wasn't even in school yet.
Wow. And so you overcome that early set of challenges and you achieve some really impressive things. I mean, you get an MD from Harvard Medical School, you become a physician, but then you get sick twice. And so it's almost as if you're pushed back, I guess, to this space of real challenge in your life. Talk about how you had to respond to that challenge.
Yes. So, you know, one of the chapters I do talk about the patient perspective, I think, is the name of that chapter. And I talk about my own challenges that I've had. And it was actually three major things. I'll talk about one of them. You have to read the book for the other. but the one I'll talk about is important because it really shaped my career. As you know, and as you mentioned at the beginning, you know, I'm an ophthalmologist. I'm a glaucoma specialist, and I probably have had, you know, if you ask someone to name the five people who's had the most influence in the world on glaucoma in Black people, you know, I'd be in that, you know, top five, maybe uh-huh. even top one or two. So I'm very well known in the area of glaucoma in Blacks and doing investigations into it and so forth. Well, the part of the reason is that when I was a first year resident at the Mass Eye and Ear Infirmary in Boston, learning about glaucoma and learning that it's a disease of old people, you know, usually 65 and older, I had an incident, which I'll tell you about in a second, but as a result of that incident, I was diagnosed with glaucoma. Hmm. And, you know, I was devastated. You know, here I am, I'm 28 years old about. I never even heard of glaucoma at that age. And that's really what got me started in investigating glaucoma in Blacks, and did a major study, the St. Lucia survey, which showed definitively that it was the first population-based study that showed that Blacks have a higher prevalence of glaucoma, that it happens earlier, and that it's more severe. Mm-hmm. So, you know, here I am, you know, a young Black man, and the research I'm doing is showing me that my I'm likely to go blind. it did influence me in the sense that as I started seeing glaucoma patients, most of them do not do well. I mean, they do ultimately lose a lot of vision and many go blind. And certainly my own research showed that that's the likely course. particularly if you're not well treated. So I decided at that time to get some extra training in epidemiology and to accept an administrative job, thinking that my career as an ophthalmic surgeon was going to be limited by my glaucoma. Now, the good news is that I've had a remarkable stable course. It really has not progressed or very little over decades. And I took care of myself for most of that time because of, you know, my self-image and growing up and being invulnerable and so forth. I didn't want to show any weaknesses. And up until 2003, I kept my diagnosis a secret and, you know, had access to medications, obviously, as a physician, had access to doing my own visual fields. As a person who had a lot of residents and fellows train under me, I made excuses for them taking my intraocular pressure, you know. So I found ways to know what my course was and took care of myself until 2003, when I decided that I really need to be under the care of a glaucoma specialist. And I did that, but it's been remarkably stable. And but I never would have predicted that based on the work that I was doing, as well as what the common knowledge was about glaucoma. I'll let you ask me some other questions.
We've only got a couple minutes left, but I do want to have you talk about how these personal experiences have shaped, this focus for you around racial disparities that exist in our healthcare system. You and I have talked about that a number of times. Right. The book really, I think, shows how your life pushes you in that direction.
Yeah. So the book is I like to think it's interesting in the sense that, you know, it does talk about my early life and some of the challenges, but it also talks about things which I built my career around. As you mentioned, health disparities, our global health, there's a chapter on that, and experiences are related to that. The way I got interested in health disparities is that I decided to do my internship at Harlem Hospital Center, because as an ophthalmologist, you have to do a year of general internal medicine. And I wanted to get away from Boston for a year to be in a different environment, since I knew I was going to be doing my ophthalmology training in Boston. So I did it at Harlem and saw a different, totally different patient demographics there, obviously. And there was this one patient who really affected me. His name was Luke, I think it was. And he had a liver problem and would come in to the emergency room all the time to get drained, because he had ascites fluid in the stomach as a result of his liver problems. And he was just using the emergency room primary care a doctor. And then one day he didn't come in, and I found out that he had died. And he was young guy, in his 20s. And it just made me think about whether if he had insurance, if he had been more affluent, if he had lived somewhere else, maybe in New Rochelle or something rather than in Harlem, he probably would not have died. He probably would have had access to medications. He would have had a different diet. And so that really spurred my interest in health disparity.
M. Roy Wilson, president here at Wayne State University. Always great to talk with you. Congratulations on this really wonderful memoir, and we look forward to it being released on May 4th. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
going to do it for us today. I'll be back tomorrow, and I hope you will too. This is 101.9 WDET-FM, Detroit's NPR station, your connection to news, music, and conversation.